Well, good morning. I want to introduce you to Dr. Evil. There he is. Dr. Evil is the megalomaniacal tyrant from the Austin Powers movies. He wants to rule the world. He wants to destroy the moon. And he wants all people on Earth to worship him and bow down before him. Now, thankfully, he's only a character in a movie. He's ridiculous. We can laugh at him. And no one really takes him seriously. But the problem is, Dr. Evil is a lot like many real tyrants that are out there in our world. And when you actually see some of these tyrannical maniacs raised up, you just realise that the stupidity of Dr. Evil is actually played out in reality, in real crimes, in real delusions of grandeur. Just this week, there's a man, Omar al-Bashir, if you've been keeping up with the news. He is currently president of the Sudan. A few days ago, he was indicted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. He is the first person who has been on the throne or in a ruling position to be indicted by the International Criminal Court. He had masterminded the killing of hundreds of thousands of his own people, Africans from the Darfur region of the Sudan. He's been convicted of a number of charges: mass murder, rape, torture, deportation. There are almost 3 million people who have been displaced in that region of his own country in the last 5 years or so. So the International Criminal Court has issued a warrant for his arrest. It has been passed on to Sudanese authorities, but it is unlikely that they will take any action. It's unlikely that they'll do anything. What was al-Bashir's response to this indictment? He expelled most of the foreign aid agencies out of his nation, and he did a dance in the street in front of all his loyal supporters who came out to rally in support for him. And so his reign of terror continues. So ridiculous, so laughable, if it wasn't so just terrible, so horrendous what he's been doing. And al-Bashir is one in a long line of evil rulers who have marked the course of human history. And you could just, every generation has them. So let me show a few. Nero. Can we just flash them up on the screen as I go? Nero. And Stalin, Nero, Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, Mussolini, Mao Zedong, Robert Mugabe. And it seems like as soon as one of these passes from the scene in our world, another one rises up. And just when we feel like we're free of their reign of terror, another one pops up, maybe somewhere else. Now this morning, as we turn to these pages of Revelation, we see that standing behind these evil men is none other than Satan himself. And if we are to rightly understand our world, then we need to perceive things that are beyond what we can actually see with our eyes. We need to recognise what Satan is doing in our world and also what God is doing in our world. So come with me to Revelation chapter 12, the passage Gordon just read out for us, the dragon and the woman and her offspring. So, John sees a woman giving birth to a child. And as the woman is born, as the child is born, this seven-headed dragon is waiting with an intention to consume or devour the child as it comes out of the womb. But the woman flees and she is protected for 1,260 days. And you think, what are we meant to make of it all? Now, you've got to start with what we know for sure. And what we know for sure is that the dragon represents Satan. Now, and you know why we know that, don't you? Verse 9, it says it explicitly. And that's a good place to start. Verse 9, the great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth and his angels with him. So the dragon is Satan. Who is the woman? Now, I reckon for us Christians, I think at a first glance that you see a lot of similarities with Mary. I don't know if you sort of had that feeling as it was read out. She gives birth to a baby who would rule all nations, a baby who from birth was pursued by the dragon. Now, you remember when Jesus was born? The dragon in that instance was Herod. Herod the Great, who slaughtered all the babies because he was told that a baby was being born who would be the king of the Jews. And in his megalomaniac, in his tyranny and his paranoia, he tried to devour this baby as it was born, but God protected the baby and they fled to Egypt, Joseph, Mary and the baby Jesus. So you can see those connections, but I don't think John wants us to limit our vision of this woman to just Mary. There's a sense to which I think, as Gordon alluded to, that this woman represents the people of God, perhaps the nation of Israel. Notice the 12 stars on her head represent the 12 tribes of Israel. But as you continue going on in the chapter, you see that you can't just confine this woman to somehow Israel. She is perhaps the faithful people of God throughout the ages because her offspring are Christians. And out of the woman, out of God's faithful people, comes the Messiah, Jesus Christ. But notice in verse 5, she gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all nations with an iron scepter, and the child was snatched up to God and to his throne. Now that is the quickest description of Jesus' birth, life, death, resurrection and ascension that you'll find in the whole Bible. There it is in one verse. Right? No sooner is he born than he's snatched up. And it's like John skips over all that stuff. And it's because that's not the focus of this chapter. The focus of this chapter is what takes place after Jesus ascends into heaven. The focus of this chapter is the age in which we live. Now that Jesus has ascended into heaven and we're still waiting for him to return, what is life like for the people of God in the age in which we live? And that's the focus of the next few chapters. So verses 7 to 13, the scene shifts and we're now in heaven. And we see the war in heaven. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. The dragon is defeated and hurled down to earth. Now, what is being described here is the consequences, the outworking of Jesus' life, death, resurrection and ascension. That is, in Jesus' death and resurrection, the New Testament wants to say that was the ultimate, the decisive defeat of Satan. Where Satan's power was stripped from him, his power to hold judgment over our heads, to keep on accusing us of our sin, because our sin was removed for all those who trust in Jesus. So the death and resurrection of Jesus was that decisive victory, and what we see in verses 7 to 13 are like the heavenly outworking of what Jesus achieved on the cross. So notice the voice from heaven in verse 10. I heard a loud voice in heaven say, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ, for the accuser of our brothers, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They didn't love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury, because he knows that his time is short." And the final scene, the rest of the chapter, the dragon has been defeated, hurled to the earth. He is defeated, but angry, vehemently angry, and he now pursues the woman and her other offspring. And her other offspring is no other than us, Christians, followers of Jesus. Now, what's the point? I think the point of this chapter is that now that Jesus has defeated Satan, Satan's attack turns towards the followers of Jesus. Jesus has overcome, but now Satan's focus shifts to Jesus' followers. It's like the defeat of Hitler in World War II. Does someone want to go and check a car? See whether there's a particular number plate going on. Is that a car alarm to you guys? So anyway, something's chipping out there, but don't worry about it. Mike's got it under control. So think about the defeat of Hitler in World War II. When did the Allies win that war? Now, from a superficial perspective, you might say at the German surrender. May the 8th, 1945, Berlin was surrounded. Hitler had committed suicide. Guns were laid down. That's when the war finally ended. But that was not when the war was won. See, most war historians would point to the D-Day invasion, right? And that was a year earlier. The invasion of Normandy in the north of France, on one day, 150,000 Allies stormed the coastline of northern France. They broke through the containment lines. And in the days and weeks that followed, there would be a million soldiers that flooded into that region and started taking Europe and heading towards Germany. From that point on, the march to Berlin was relentless. Hitler was a defeated foe, and he knew it. But did that mean the hostilities ceased? Did that mean guns were laid down and no one was hurt from that point on? Of course not. In fact, the hostilities, if anything, escalated. Hitler was defeated, but he would go down fighting. And that's what's happening with Satan. 2,000 years ago was the decisive defeat through the death and resurrection of Jesus. Satan was stripped of his power. The dragon was thrown to the earth. And since then, he has been waging war against us Christians. He is defeated, but angry. And some of the fiercest persecution of Christians throughout history is happening right now all over the world. This last century, right? What was last century? 20th century? The worst century on record in terms of Christian martyrdom. It was a terrible, bloody century against the people of God. And even here in peaceful Australia, it is hard being a Christian, isn't it? We face opposition and persecution. Sometimes it's subtle, but it's just this subtle undermining and mockery and put down that just wears you down over time. But what we're seeing is that behind this opposition stands none other than Satan, the defeated but angry foe. And the victory of Jesus ultimately is certain. So come over to chapter 13 and we see the two horrible beasts. See, chapter 13 begins with the dragon on the shore of the sea, and then out of the sea comes this first beast. A beast of the sea, 10 horns, 7 heads, 10 crowns on his horns. Verse 2, the beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. Now, I don't know if we were looking at the book of Daniel last year. And I looked up at my PowerPoints, my presentation from the book of Daniel, chapter 7. Remember, Daniel sees four beasts. Right? Oh, yeah, go back to the four beasts. So that he saw a bear, a leopard, a lion, and another terrible beast. And they represented kingdoms that were raised up. They represented the Medes and the Persians and the Babylonians and the Greeks in their first instance. But here, this beast that John sees is like Daniel 7's beasts all rolled into one. See the description again? Resembled a leopard, had feet like those of a bear, mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power So this is a continuation of that beastly character of world leadership and tyrants that Daniel saw in Daniel 7. And notice in verses 7 and 8, the beast was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. He was given authority over every tribe, people, language and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the beginning of the world. See, now humanity is divided into two. There are only two types of humanity: those who worship the beast and those who worship the Lamb, Jesus Christ. And there is no in between. You either worship the beast or you worship Jesus. You either choose to worship Jesus or you actually worship the beast by default. And how long will this beast terrorize God's people? Can we just flash that question up there? How long? Well, look at verse 5. The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise his authority for 42 months. Now, notice back in chapter 12, verse 6. See what it says? The woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. How many months is 1,260 days? Anyone want to take a guess? If you're not good at maths. 42 months. So go on to the next one. I've put the 3.5 years. Oh, there you go. I've actually made a mistake in my writing. So chapter 12, verse 6, 1,260 days. Chapter 12, verse 14, notice there, the woman was given the two wings of a great eagle so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the desert, where she would be taken care of for time, times, and half a time. Time, times, and half a time. Now, as Gordon said, we've got these symbol-laden phrases in the book of Revelation, but I take it that is time, one, times, another two, and half a time is totals 3.5. 3.5 years, which is exactly the same time frame as 42 months or 1,260 days. Can you see that what we're talking about is just the same time frame in different ways of speaking about it? But then you've got to ask the question, well, what is the significance? What does the time frame mean? And what I want to say is that in apocalyptic literature like Revelation, numbers carry significance. Numbers are dripping with significance. Now, I'll give you a modern day example. Have a look at this number up on the screen. 911. Right. Now, what is the significance of that number? At one level, it's just the number after 910 and the number before 912. But I bet you if I put 912 up on the screen, it wouldn't evoke nearly what the numbers 911 evoke. So what does it do for you? What comes to mind? Okay, so we're talking about America. I'll talk about two things about this number. Firstly, what do you do when you're in an emergency in America? You call 911. Even if you're in McDonald's and you order chicken McNuggets and they haven't got chicken McNuggets, you ring 911. I don't know if you heard about that this week, but a few days ago, that's what a woman did, and she made three calls to 911 because she'd paid for chicken McNuggets and the woman wasn't giving them to her. It was a national emergency at that point. So the number carried that significance already, but then, with the events of 8 years ago, that number will never be the same again, because 9/11 evokes the terrible crashing down, the terrorist act of the World Trade Center, where those two planes flew into the towers and brought them crashing down. And so whenever I googled the number 9/11, right, and just in the images, and the images of the World Trade Center just came up one after the other. That's what the name symbolizes for, that's what this number symbolizes for us. It's more than just an ordinary number, you might say. So, come back to this number, 42 months. All right? 1,260 days times time, time times and half a time. Now, for a Jew in the first century, 42 months, I want to argue, brought echoes of the terrible persecution of Antiochus Epiphanes back in 167 BC. So you can write the date down, you can go and check it out. But way back in 167 BC, Antiochus stopped the temple sacrifices. He sacrificed pigs in the temple of God's people. He made circumcision illegal. He actively persecuted the Jews and put many of them to death. It was a time when the Maccabees rose up in revolt against Antiochus. Now, how long did Antiochus' reign of terror last? Do you want to have a guess? 42 months. That is 3.5 years, 1,260 days. And then the people were liberated from that reign of terror. And numbers work like that. Once that number has been entrenched in your national psyche, you can just throw that number around and automatically the associations come. And the prophet Daniel had foretold the same period of time. Daniel chapter 7 verse 25, Daniel chapter 12 verse 7 talks about time, times and half a time, the 3.5 year period. To a Jew in the first century, 42 months, I want to argue, symbolizes a terrible time of persecution that is cut short, that will not go on forever. And so it requires patient endurance and faithfulness to ride out the storm until the tyrant is done away with. And so I take it the first beast in Revelation 13 represents government or world power that is opposed to God and to his people. So it might be Antiochus Epiphanes in the 2nd century BC, or Nero in the 1st century, or last century we had Stalin and Hitler and Mussolini and Robert Mugabe, al-Bashir, yep. These tyrants come and their reign is terrible. They are human agents of the dragon, Satan himself. But just as Satan's time is short, so these tyrants will not last forever. There is hope and encouragement in the midst of the terrible persecution. Notice verse 3, chapter 13, verse 3. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Men worshipped the dragon because he'd given authority to the beast. And they also worshipped the beast and asked, "Who is like the beast? Who can make war against him?" Can you see echoes of Jesus Christ in the beast? And that is, there's some sort of mock resurrection going on. He's got a fatal wound, which means you die, and yet it's healed. And so here with the beast, there's some sort of resurrection, which I take it, I think it's alluding to the whole idea that, yes, one beastly world leader, you know, Nero dies, and yet the beast is not done away with. Another tyrant will rise again. And then when that one dies, another and another. None of them last forever, but the beast continues to rise up generation after generation, and it will be only at the return of Jesus that the beast is ultimately defeated. Now, chapter 13 doesn't only speak of the beast from the sea. There's another beast. In verse 11, I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb. These echoes of Christ-likeness. But he spoke like a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf. And he made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed. and he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. He ordered them to set up an image in honour of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. Now, if the first beast is evil world power, then the second beast is evil religion or evil philosophy that accompanies, that even endorses that evil government. The second beast is later called the false prophet. Now, this has been the pattern throughout history. Remember in the time of Pharaoh, you had evil Pharaoh, but you had his court of magicians who would come and do the same sort of miracles that Moses was doing, and they were endorsing evil Pharaoh. Same in the time of Nebuchadnezzar. What did he have? His court of wise men and astrologers and magicians. As evil governments and world powers rise up, so evil religions and philosophies rise up to support, to endorse. The second beast serves the first beast, and together they create suffering for God's people. Now, have you noticed the similarities between the dragon and the two beasts and the Trinity? I just think it's worth just pointing out some similarities. See, in John's Gospel, right? John's writing the book of Revelation, but in John's Gospel, John talks about the Father, God the Father, who sends the Son and he gives authority to the Son. And then they both send the Holy Spirit, who gives glory and honour to the Father and the Son. Here in Revelation 13, there is that sort of trinity, an anti-trinity, you might say. You have Satan, the dragon. He gives authority to the first beast. And the first beast is the Antichrist. His fatal wound, yes, but he lives on. And then the second beast brings honour and glory to the first beast and to the dragon. See, what we have here are two trinities. Two objects demanding our worship. The real and the fake. And every person on the planet worships either one or the other. You either receive the mark of the Lamb or the mark of the beast. They are the only two options for every single person on the planet. And I want to say, before we get too comfortable, and I know this is quite disturbing, so it's unlikely you're too comfortable, but I want to point out that the beast is not merely the Hitlers and Neros of our world. Remember when the US invaded Iraq? And it seemed like here they are removing another beast, Saddam Hussein. It seemed black and white. But then reports started coming out in 2004 about the US military police and their treatment of prisoners in the Abu Ghraib prison. Reports, I don't know if you remember, reports of abuse, torture, sodomy, homicide. They just did despicable, disgusting actions, totally degrading and mocking and terrorising their prisoners. It was beastly behaviour by the good guys. Or so we thought. And we face this disturbing realisation that the beast is not just Iraq. It's not just Sudan or Zimbabwe. The beast is amongst us too. Evil abuse of power, undermining God and his people. It is not just the great evil tyrants of our world who do it. We feel it every day. And sometimes it's not that overt hostility and persecution. Sometimes it's not with the martyrdom of Christians, but the subtle undermining and mockery of Christianity. The way our newspapers are just so dismissive, feel just so at liberty to put Christianity down, to push it to the perimeter as if it was irrelevant. The subtle ways our world's value system and the world's way of thinking creeps in and takes over and draws us away from worship of Jesus. The beast is not always dressed like Adolf Hitler. So verse 10, second half of verse 10, this calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. This is a difficult time in which we live. The period between the death, resurrection and ascension of Jesus and his final return is a period of turmoil and persecution for the people of God. That is the character of this age in which we live. Be patient. Be faithful. And verse 18, this calls for wisdom, discernment, the need to be on our guard against Satan and his schemes and against his earthly agents. Now I'm going to pause there. I've got a few things to say about chapter 14, but chapter 14 is very heavy, right? You thought chapters 12 and 13 were heavy. Have you got any questions that you want to raise out of chapters 12 and 13 before I come on to chapter 14? It's all so straightforward, isn't it? Shirley. 666. Another one of those numbers, isn't it? So verse 18, I'll read it out. This calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. His number is 666. And it's sort of it's this gaping hole in my sermon so far, isn't it? Sort of, you know, I've explained 1260 well enough. What do you do with 666? Now, I don't exactly know, but I'll give you a bit of an answer. Let me run with it, right? Within Jewish thought world, numbers, letters represent numbers. And so a name can carry a numeric value. And I've discovered this week that David, the name David, has a numeric value. Does anyone know what number David is? Not seven? No. The number 14, right? 4, 6, 4, 14. And it seems from my readings that Matthew chapter 1, the focus on the 14 generation, three lots of 14 generations, is partly a focus on David and the new King David, or the one coming in the line of David. So we're talking about a world that used numbers to represent names because they didn't have numbers in the same sort of way. Numbers were indicated by letters, right? So it's a bit of a different way of thinking. And so there have been many attempts to take this number and work out what is the significance of the number. And let me tell you some of the options. So Nero, if you take the name Nero, transliterate it into Hebrew and slightly misspell it, it adds up to 666. You can do the same with Domitian, the guy who was the emperor who was persecuting the Christians in the time John was writing, 666. And there's hundreds of options. Martin Luther had calculated it to be Pope Benedictine, and that was the beast. As I was reading it this week and seeing all the bank card. Remember the bank card, the B, and which looks like a 666. Is that the mark of the beast? You know, and it's to do with commerce. Now, when I was thinking about this week, I was reminded of my old Datsun 180B. And when, if I ever lost my keys to the Datsun 180B, I wasn't worried at all. I could open it with any key. In fact, I could get a screwdriver and open it, or a, you know, fork or whatever I wanted to. And It feels a little bit like that with 666, and that is, it seems like if you want to attach a certain historical figure to the number, you can work out a way to do it. Any key unlocks this door, so to speak. Now, so I think I say that by way of saying just don't get too carried away with a specific identification of this person is this person. It could have been much more obvious to the people back in the first century. In John's day, they could have read it and said, yeah, that is Nero Caesar. It's clear. And there might have been, they might have had good reason for seeing that. But what I'm arguing in this chapter is that even if there is a specific identification given to the beast, it doesn't exhaust the beast, because Nero came and went, and then another tyrant came up, and another. And so I think the number 666, or the beast, represents just that human tyrannical world powers that oppose themselves to God and his people. And some people say, well, if you've got God is 777, and some apocalyptic writing actually does say God is 777, do you just say 666 means nothing more than that? That is, a sort of an attempt to strive at God but falling short. 666. And I reckon that's probably as good an explanation as you're going to get. Why didn't I just say that at the start? Any other questions? Yeah, that was a long question. I sort of had wondered whether someone might ask me that question. I thought I did my best. Okay, we'll come on to chapter 14. In chapter 14, verse 1. Then I looked, and there before me was the Lamb, standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. Right, these 144,000 represent all those who follow Jesus. Right? It's not meant to be a literal number again. It's 12 times 12 times 10 times 10 times 10. Right? That is, that 12 is so much dripping with significance of the people of God. Here is the people of God in totality. In World War II, Switzerland were neutral, or so I'm led to believe. They weren't taking sides in the war. But what we're seeing in Revelation is that in the war between God and Satan, there is no Switzerland. There is no sitting on the fence unless you have the mark of Jesus, his tattoo stamped on your forehead, then you have the mark of the beast. Unless you follow Jesus, you follow Satan, whether you intend to or not. There are only two types of people in our world. And chapter 14 ends with three pictures of judgment. Firstly, you have an angel flying through the air proclaiming the eternal gospel. Fear God, give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and the springs of water. And that's what we've got to be doing in our world, is calling people to worship God, to worship the Lamb, to turn aside from following the beast. But then there are these terrible images of judgment. These are some of the most horrific images in the whole Bible. Verse 9. The third angel followed them, said in a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and his image and receives his mark on his forehead or on the hand, he too will drink the wine of God's fury, which has been poured full strength into the cup of his wrath. He will be tormented with burning sulphur in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment rises forever and ever. There is no rest, day or night, for those who worship the beast and his image, or for anyone who receives the mark of his name." Now, this is a description of hell, and it is just appalling, and I shudder at the thought of it, at the thought that I or someone I love could ever go there. It is just so horrendous. the smoke of their torment rises forever and ever. And finally, the judgment is described as the great end time harvest. And an angel is commanded to take a sharp sickle to gather the bunches of grapes from the earth. Verse 19, the angel swung his sickle on the earth, gathered its grapes, and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. They were trampled in the winepress outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press, rising as high as the horses' bridles for a distance of 1,600 stadia. It's just this overwhelming image of bloodshed and destruction of the opponents of God. And it's a picture of blood being squeezed out of this wine press, 6 foot high for 300 kilometres all around. Now, why does it have to come to this? Why does it have to come to this? Why does the final judgment need to be so bloody, so decisive, and so horrible? Well, it's because God wants to do away with evil. And God will do away with evil. And all of us long for that day, don't we? Don't we yearn for the day when just evil men and wicked deeds, when they are done away with and dealt with forever? But some enemies refuse to surrender. And that's the problem. Some enemies refuse to surrender. So I'll give you an example. In 1938, Britain's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, he was faced with the mounting threat of Hitler, Nazi Germany. They knew it was a very present and real danger. So he did everything he could to avoid war. In 1938, he signed the Munich Agreement with Hitler. He came home waving the agreement and saying, "I believe it is peace in our time." That's 1938. Within the next few months, Czechoslovakia and then Poland were demolished, crushed by the military might of Hitler and his armies. The promise of peace was short-lived, and Hitler's reign of terror was only just starting to come into full effect. And Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, was forced to declare Britain at war. The only way to stop Hitler's evil was by killing Hitler. No amount of negotiation and peace settlements would work with a tyrant like Hitler. And that's what the Bible is saying about Satan and his beasts. They will not surrender. There are no peace agreement that will work. They are so hardened towards God that they will go down fighting. Even though they know they are a defeated foe, they still rage against God and his people. And tragically, there are many who follow Satan and the beast. And they don't even know that they're doing it. But they refuse to surrender to Jesus. And sometimes it is even the people we love. And if they continue to refuse, then there will come a day when they will have to drink the wine of God's fury, as described in chapter 14. And so we're torn. We so long for justice and yearn for that day when Jesus returns. And yet there are people we love who are still refusing to surrender. And we just got to pray that they will before the day when Jesus returns. How about I lead us in prayer? Our Father, as we read these passages, we think of our brothers and sisters throughout the world. So many of them are just facing terrible danger and persecution and hostility, being killed or displaced, being hated, and just so battling to stand and remain faithful in the midst of overwhelming enemies. And Father, even here in Australia, we pray for ourselves, as with our brothers and sisters overseas, that you will give us patience to endure, that you'll give us the wisdom to keep trusting, the wisdom to discern when Satan's schemes are seeking to lead us astray. And Father, as we hear of this final judgment, it lays heavy. It is a burden on our hearts. We think of our families and friends, our neighbours, our workmates, many of them we love, and yet many of them are still refusing to surrender. And so whilst we recoil at the horror of that final judgment, we also rejoice because we long for the day when evil will be done away with and defeated once and for all. So, Father, please help us to live with wisdom in the time in which we are, to take every opportunity we have to declare the eternal gospel and call people to worship the Lamb. And we also pray that we will be able to pray with all your people, come, Lord Jesus, come. Amen.